big loss and feeling like they don't know who they are anymore. And a lot of it's just your sense of the world changes, you know, your idea of what's possible, what's safe, what can happen in the world really shifts. And then you can begin to experience yourself on all these new levels of vulnerability, a fear, the guilt, shame you might feel, you know, all of these really deep cavernous places within ourselves that we often haven't touched like this before. And they can be quite shocking for so many people. I think this is where a lot of anxiety comes in. You know, you suddenly don't trust yourself to go into work and like be the person you used to be, or to go to a party, or to be in your marriage, or whatever it is. You know, you're just not who you used to be. And it takes a little time to find this new version of yourself. And there is so much grief there of like, wait, I just really miss this person I used to. I used to be a little happier. I used to, you know, be a little more confident. I used to be naive. I used to feel safe in the world. And now I'm so different.
Welcome back, my friends, to Grief is a Sneaky Bitch podcast. I'm your host, Lisa Kefauver. There are some themes most grievers experience, regardless of the source of their loss. That can include things like loss of self-identity, heightened feelings of guilt, time spent ruminating on the what ifs, and increased anxiety and fear. What makes these typical experiences even more challenging is that they're so rarely named by others or shown in the media. And so we often feel even further isolated from the world and uncertain how to get ourselves unstuck. That's why I'm so grateful for the words and wisdom of my guest today, Claire Bidwell Smith. In her recent book, Conscious Grieving, and in our conversation today, she opens up about her personal experiences with these themes in the wake of the death of both of her parents when she was in her 20s. Over the course of her career as a grief therapist, both in private practice and hospice, she's gained such deep insight on how we move through various phases in grief, or orientations, as she calls them. She helps us unpack what we might face in each and the roadblocks that can get in our way. From her wisdom to her soft and warm voice, you are going to feel guided with care through today's conversation. Hello, everyone. I'm so excited to welcome. You can see her for yourself if you're watching us finally on YouTube. I'm getting my act together finally to doing a video as well. But welcome, Claire Bidwell Smith, to the show. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you, Lisa. I'm so happy to be here.
Oh, it's so great to be in conversation. If you all have been listening to the show, you know, and you care about grief, then I know you already know Claire Bidwell Smith and her work, her beautiful memoir, Rules of Inheritance, the work she's done helping us really understand anxiety as a critical and really unspoken part of grief in our lives. And today she's joining me to explore her new book, which when this episode drops will be out and live. I'm lucky enough to have gotten an advanced reader copy. It's called Conscious Grieving, A Transformative Approach to Healing from Loss. And Claire, I cannot wait. Y'all, YouTubers, you can see sticky notes and underlines. That's why I always tell people, you got to go buy your own copy because you can't borrow my copy of the book. But anyway, so excited.
Thank you.
I'm so excited to dive into this today.
Thank you.
Yeah. So you all heard at the top of the show, in addition to being a writer, Claire is a grief therapist and does all kinds of phenomenal work. I just had the privilege of seeing her give a talk at the Endwell Symposium just a few weeks ago here in LA. So we're going to dive in, hopefully a little bit to your story, just for those of folks who don't know you. And then I really want to dive into the way you laid out this book and how you're helping people walk through the orientations, as you call them, of grief. And we're going to dive into that. But I'd like to start our conversation where I start with all of my guests. And I'm curious to hear, because of such early losses that you faced, but I always am trying to unpack where our grief beliefs came from. And so I ask every guest on the show for these past five seasons,
an earliest memory of loss and grief, and how were the adults in your life modeling that? What do you think that taught you back then? You know, maybe little Claire, about what grief should or shouldn't look like or feel like. Can you think of an early memory of loss? Yeah.
You know, I have had so much loss in my life, but it started really early. Well, I mean, my parents were these big predominant losses that also were pretty early in my adolescence, but there was just so much before that too. My nanny died in my house while I was taking a nap when I was very, very little. And I was alone with her, and my mom came home and couldn't find her. And she was dead on the bathroom floor in my mother's bedroom. And I was asleep taking a nap. And I was like 5 years old. I know. I haven't even written about it anywhere.
Yeah.
But yeah, my mom came home and couldn't find her or me, and then found her gone in the bathroom. And I was asleep. And I have no memory of that. I sometimes wonder if maybe I was awake, or I don't know, you know, I don't know.
That age is so hard because our memory formation is so, at that time. Yeah.
But my memory of her death begins sitting in the backseat of my father's big black Lincoln Town Car, and my mom turning around in the front seat and saying to me, Johnny is gone. Her name was Johnny. And she said, Johnny is gone. And I was like, what do you mean? And she said, she's died and gone to heaven. And she had this, like, Johnny had this like house dress she would always wear when she was at our house. And she was like a housekeeper nanny. And I took it to school with me for like months. It was like, it became like a security blanket.
Blanket. Yeah.
Yeah. And my mom let me, which I thought was really nice. I just wanted to take it with me everywhere for a long time.
Yeah.
And I did. And I do remember that I wasn't allowed to go to the funeral, and I was really sad about that.
Yeah.
And that's something I really think that children should be more included in these grief rituals. Yeah. And I remember, like, way back then being so little and being sad about not being able to go to that.
Yeah. Yeah. So common. I hear that, as you can imagine, so often with so many guests on the show. Actually, the reason I'm named Lisa, which, newsflash, I'm technically Susan, for all of you who do not know that, but I didn't find out till I was an adult that the reason my name is Lisa is because my mom had a childhood friend that died, and she wasn't allowed to go to the funeral, and she had vowed when she grew up she was going to name her daughter after her friend Lisa, which I didn't know till I was already doing grief work. So I was like, was I destined to be doing this work? I'm not sure.
Anyhow, yeah. I have a daughter named after a friend who died.
Yeah. Okay. Well, what I want to sidetrack to my story of my name, but really was just honoring two things that you said there, the both and of really what your mom sort of modeled for you, which was one, which is very much of the time too, by the way. I always want to give our parents a break because they were doing the best they can with the grief knowledge of the time. Oh, it's too, you know, children shouldn't go to funerals, it's too young. And really letting you have that connection to Johnny by bringing her house coat, or, you know, as a security blanket in a way, to school. So there was, you know, some both and messages there around carrying her memory forward, or being still keeping a connection to somebody after they've passed, but also, maybe not understanding what children are, what children need, including ritual. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So you mentioned, and I know, I imagine that you've had this conversation on shows in the past, but I don't think we can dive into this beautiful book without helping us understand sort of not just the professional wisdom that you've gained to get where you are, because of course you are a grief therapist and you studied and this is your specialty, you know, in the professional lane of your life. But you also, as you alluded to, went through a series of profound losses quite young, starting with the diagnosis of both of your parents of cancer at 14. I think I remember if I read that. Yeah.
Yeah. So go ahead.
No. So you come by this work sort of, again, how could it have almost been any other way, given what you've been through?
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, I always wanted to be a writer. That's all I wanted to be. Yeah. I was an only child and I was lonely and, you know, my parents were older and I just read books all the time. And I began writing at a really early age. And that was all I ever wanted to be when I grew up. And that's what I thought I would be.
Yeah. And, well, as it turns out, you are also. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. And so that early diagnosis of both of your parents, I wondered when you look back now too, when we think about all the work that you do now, right, around naming hard feelings and holding space for the inevitability, by the way, 100% of us are going to go, not what a 14-year-old needs to understand or, you know, really come to grips with. But when you look back, were the times through the illness, and I believe, I apologize if I don't have this right, did your father pass first?
No, my mom, when
your mother
18,
passed first. Yeah. Okay. Were there open conversations about what was happening around mortality? No.
No, not at all. Not at all. Okay. I mean, I think partly that was the time, the culture, but it was also like my mother was much sicker than my father. She was diagnosed with stage 4 colon cancer a few months after he had received a diagnosis of prostate cancer. And he was older, and prostate cancer was not that uncommon for a man his
yeah.
age. It seemed very treatable, but my mother's cancer was much more severe. And so she was very scared and she did not want to die and didn't want to talk about it. And so we didn't talk about it. And my father was kind of a, you know, he was a World War II veteran. And so yeah. he was
stoic.
He was not going to talk about his feelings either. And so we just didn't, you know, and for that reason, there was a lot of missed opportunities for conversations, for understanding. I mean, her death came as a shock to me, even though she was sick for 4.5 years and gravely ill. But no one prepared me for
no
her
one
death
named
or
that.
Talked about
yeah.
it. Yeah.
Oh, my heart breaks for teenage Claire. And I think, again, like, as you said, that was kind of the time. That was just the nature of your parents. It was probably the nature of where your parents were raised by their parents.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yeah, and absolutely.
And I wonder, too, when did you then shift then, given these profound experiences, given maybe looking back, of course, with love and compassion for your parents, that they didn't prepare you or have the conversations in the way that you wish you would. When did you make that transition from, I think I'm going to be a writer, to there's something about this grief experience and the way we talk about it in our culture or don't talk about it, and led you down that path? And led
Hold
you
on.
Down that path. Yeah.
I've got a cat situation. I might have to put a cat. Let me put a cat outside.
Pause for a cat situation, everybody.
Cat situation. Come on. Go outside. Get out of here. My house is crawling with like books and pets and children. I love it.
I
all.
Mean,
it's
exactly.
a little chaotic.
No, all good. All good.
You know, to answer your question, it was what's interesting and what's sad and what I see a lot in clients even today and people I work with is that I never held it against my parents. I only blamed myself.
Yes.
So obviously, it wasn't my fault. I'm 45 years old now, and I understand that in many different ways and have come to understand that in many different ways with maturity and through the work I do. And but all the years that I sat in so much blame and self-hatred, really, for not having understood that my mother was dying, not having said goodbye to her, not having been there the night she died. You know, I can look back now and fully understand that that was kind of set up for me, by them, but by our culture at large. But I really just held myself accountable for a long time, and it was really painful.
Yeah, yeah. How did you begin to turn the corner of recognizing? Like, was it going and getting your professional degree? Was it much later into the work that you were doing when you were seeing clients and you sort of started to put the, like, wait a minute, why am I holding myself to account for something that I had, you know, no reasonable expectation to have?
I mean, I had to really hit rock bottom. So my mom died when I was a freshman in college. And then my father died like 6.5 years later. right after I had finished college, because I took some time off after she died and then finally finished school. And so he died when I was 25. And I had very different experiences of both of their deaths. Hers was a shock. She, you know, died doing all these last trial minute
heroic
efforts. You know.
Yeah,
but they were so harrowing too. You know, I mean, she had a colostomy bag, and the quality of life she had at the time, if she had lived at all, would have been really terrible. But my father took a different tactic and didn't want to do all of those things and chose to die at home with hospice and asked me to really accompany him on that journey. And it was very beautiful. However, when he was gone, I was 25 and had no immediate family. And it was really hard. It was nothing any of my peers were going through. I had a lot of grief and anxiety and just existential questions. And I just felt very alone. And so there was a period of years where I kind of descended into like alcohol and toxic relationships and just this like loneliness. And when I kind of hit some real rock bottom places of that, I felt like there was nothing left to do but like therapy and yoga and like meditation and self-compassion. Yeah. And with those things came this ability to be like, oh, I'm like a human trying to just be a human in the world. And this isn't easy for anybody. But it took like weeping on yoga mats, you know, of just like sitting in my humanity. And then from there, as I climbed out, I began to work in grief and in hospice. And then I saw, oh, we all go through this. We all blame ourselves and we all have these missed opportunities around grief because our culture doesn't support it. And so the forgiveness and the self-compassion just grew from there.
Yeah. Well, that's so beautiful. And your own personal experience is so evident in this book, because the themes that you just talked about there around like holding ourselves to account and the rumination and the guilt, but also the importance of self-compassion and recognizing, you know, the centrality of our humanity, that there isn't a person here. That all comes out really beautifully in this book. I know it obviously, you touched on anxiety, which I think we'll touch on a little bit here, but that was so important to you that that was an entire other book or piece of work. And not that you can encapsulate a book, but what did you learn about anxiety and why was it important to say like, whoa, wait a minute here, we need to be talking about this missing piece of grief? What do we need to know
about
that?
That was one of my predominant experiences of grief after my mother died. I mean, I was just gripped with panic attacks, hypochondria, you know, social phobias. I was in the ER, you know, I was a mess. And I didn't connect it to my grief. You know, now I look back and I'm like, of course.
Duh.
Of course I was going through that because my mom died and my dad was going to die soon. But at the time, there was nobody was talking about anxiety in connection to grief. And I couldn't find anything about it. So I just thought there was something else wrong with me. And it was later when I was taking a trauma psychology class in school, and I was like, PTSD. I was like, I don't have trauma, but but there's something here that maybe all of that anxiety I'm experiencing is connected to losing my parents.
Yeah.
And I started to really study it, and I started to figure out how to heal from it too. And that was my own personal journey of kind of trying to really learn how to heal from my anxiety. And then I began to write about it because I write about everything. Suddenly all these people came flooding in to see me saying, oh, is this a thing? This like grief and anxiety? Because I think I have it. My person died and I'm really anxious and I'm a mess all of a sudden. So then I was able to really study it in a pretty wide population. And I was like, oh, I've got to like put this out there. This is, people need to know and people need to understand that this is absolutely a part of grief, not for everybody, but for a lot of us.
Yeah.
And that there
and
are
on different scales or sort of different intensity
manifestations.
Levels.
Yeah. But there's ways to heal from it and it's normal and it's understandable.
Yeah. So, No, I so appreciate that. And, I'm definitely a person in the various losses that I've faced have had different levels of anxiety. And it really wasn't until more recent years that, to be honest, wasn't necessarily the predominant experience for me. I'm actually experiencing it a lot as I navigate cancer myself and the grief and loss over my disease. And then, you know, the coming up of like doing all of this without my husband, you know, who died of cancer. And so I do appreciate that. And naming anxiety as an example of just the power of how important the power of naming something to allow people to feel, oh, it's not just me, right? And that this is a part of what this experience is. And then it gives us some tools because we retreat when we experience things that feel like it's just something that I'm going through. So then it keeps us even more isolated, right? And thus the cycle continues.
Yeah.
So this book I thought was so interesting, the way that you, different than other books that you've written and other books out there, but I really appreciated one of the things, as you all can see, there was many things I appreciated about the book. But how you helped us walk through kind of, you call them orientations, which I loved that word because, of course, stages has got us all thinking we could just go through a checklist and be done with things. But you helped us, you sort of walk through and naming for us. These are the kinds of things that might be coming up for you in this orientation or this phase or this time in your grief. And then here are some of the tools that you might consider. And so you really made a book that people could sort of drop into, I think. You know, whether it was 1 year down the road or 20 years down the road, and they're finally coming to grips with it. So you have these four orientations: entering, engaging, surrendering, transforming. Why was it important to sort of create your book around this, around these orientations? What was it?
I just thought a lot about what I see. You know, I've been in private practice for 15 years now. I have sat with so many different kinds of grief and loss and obviously a lot of my own. And there is a process. You know, I think there's so many different models of grief out there and ideas of it. And I think people seek them out because they want some framework and some understanding for this huge thing they're going through. Like, please let me have something to hold on to.
Some order in the chaos.
Yeah. And I get that. But I just really wanted to sit down and think about what is it that I know and what is it that I see. And I think there is a process, you know, obviously it's a little different for everyone, but I think that we kind of, you know, come into grief and we enter into it and it's not something we asked for or sought.
We're shoved in, I like to say.
Exactly. Yeah. And it's often a startling experience. I think grief is so much bigger and more unwieldy than most people are prepared for. And so there's a disorientation and there's, you know, a kind of like coming to terms with this new landscape that happens. And then from there, I feel like we do begin to engage with it in some way, whether it's resisting it, that's that's a form of engaging on some levels, or whether we're, you know, leaning into it. And my philosophy of this book is that the more we can lean into grief, the more that, we can actually move through it and, you know, learn from it. I think that grief can be an incredible opportunity. It's wildly painful. And I don't want to deny anyone.
It's not an opportunity we ever wanted. And
it's
an opportunity. Yeah,
it is. We have no choice but to let it, you know, change us in so many ways. But I think that when we can surrender to it, there's a lot to learn. I mean, grief is the thing that really pares everything down to its essence, right? It's like, you really know what matters to you and what doesn't, and you can toss a lot out the window and you can think, okay, here's what the world means to me. A very narrow lens, which is kind of an incredible opportunity in some ways. Painful.
Yeah.
But
painful. Yeah. I call those the AFGOs of my life, another fucking growth opportunity.
Yes.
And I agree. And if you're listening and you're way earlier in your grief and you're maybe in that entering phase and you don't want to hear about it being an opportunity and a lesson, it's okay. I hear
Absolutely.
You. If somebody would have said that to me early on, which they did in their various ways, you know, everything happens for a reason, stuff people try to say, it's okay to just pause and just keep an open mind. As you listen to this conversation, as you read this book, when you're ready, because that is something that I've myself and worked with grievers for a long time in various forms over my social work career. And I've never met anybody who didn't find some, as you said, getting really clear about what my values are, getting really clear about what matters in the world, getting clear about our relationships. Yeah, there's an opportunity there. Yeah. I wanted to touch on the engaging phase, starting with what you just said, which was we can engage even when we're not engaging, meaning like when you're stuck in a rumination and guilt and shame or denial, that is a form of engagement. And good news, bad news is the only way through is to engage. Darn it. But, you know, you touch on a couple of subjects that I think, again, like anxiety, maybe even more common in anxiety, I'm curious, is guilt and rumination, which are two ways in a way in which we're actually not moving forward with. We're trying to cling, you know, kind of cling on to the versions of where we were, because rumination invites us, right, to try to find a different outcome than the one that actually happened. But I'd love to read this and explore a little bit around guilt and rumination and kind of the things that you want folks to know. But you just wrote with such compassion. Like, as a reader, I really felt your voice of like, I know you're thinking these things and having these thoughts and these feelings, and that's normal. And let me offer you a different perspective to see how to move forward. And you were saying sort of this about guilt, you said, and just kind of the replaying of moments over and over again in your mind. You said, replaying moments and blaming yourself for not making different decisions, but all you're really doing is just wishing that your person was still here. You're wishing that things could have been different, that there had been a different outcome. You're trying to find a way to make an alternate reality come to life. This is completely understandable and very normal. It's you wanting to feel control in an uncontrollable world. It's you wanting your person back. And I just really, I don't know that there's a griever who hasn't been in that cycle, right? Yeah. Because it is a way of trying to comprehend the incomprehensible or try to control the uncontrollable. And that is neurophysiologically a threat to us to feel out of control. What have you learned yourself and through your clients that you want our listeners to know about how we, on those ruminations and the scenarios we play out in our head, if I had only did or said?
I feel like I could write a whole book on just guilt. I think it's a huge theme in grief. And Elizabeth Kubler-Ross had a great quote that said something like, guilt is perhaps grief's most painful companion. Yeah. And I like the word companion actually in that sentence, because guilt does seem to be such a companion to grief. And I think in many ways it's a way of how we hold on to our person, you know? I see so many people who, if they were to let go of the guilt, let go of this thing they wish they had done differently, it's almost like then they're okay with their person being gone. Right. And so they don't want to be okay with that. And we shouldn't, you know, why would you ever want to be okay with that? I wasn't there the night my mother died. And for years, you know, it was this thing that I ruminated on and that just ate me up. And I had moments where I was like, wow, if I were just to wake up tomorrow and no longer feel guilty that I wasn't there, remorseful that I wasn't there, then it would almost be like, I don't care, or that it didn't matter.
Right.
And that was what I couldn't let go of. But, you know, Colin Campbell wrote in his book, Finding the Words, about guilt that I hadn't really thought of in this way, but he said it's a form of denial. That it's a way of staying in denial, which I really think is important to note as well, you know? And it's a way of just putting off the reality of what has happened. Yeah. If we can keep ruminating on this thing, keep trying these different scenarios, what if I had done this? What if I had done that? We're putting off sitting and accepting the reality that this has happened, you know?
Yeah.
So guilt has many different facets and many different layers. And I just think it's so often, you know, this way of just trying to stay close to them and trying to also feel that control, you know, like, I have so much control over the world that if I could just go back and do these things, because if we accept that we don't, that's like a whole new realm. And that's where the anxiety comes in.
Right? You know, like an existential crisis is born then. If I can't control these hard things happening, you know, then how can I even step outside of my front door on any given day.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that, yeah, that's where people end up just sitting and being like, I can't move. I'm paralyzed with the, what is this world?
Yeah. Well, I appreciate that. And yeah, I had that conversation with, Colin last season on the show. And I've had this conversation with clients, but also I've been the recipient of this conversation, with a meditation teacher I had for years who I adore around, this notion that our guilt and our rumination keeps us, we think, connected to our person. Mm-hmm. It's not just that we want to sort of control and it's an existential crisis if we can't imagine this, our all-powerful beings, like, you know, creating a different outcome, but that keeps their memory alive in a way, right, in our sense. And one of the biggest fears, I think, especially as we move on from year one to year two and on, the fear that we're going to lose them all over again because we won't have the memory and we won't have the connection. And I think there's so many better ways to hold on to our people than guilt.
But
exactly. But it's so hard to convince us because I do think there is a little bit of a leap of faith there at that crossroads when you are letting go of the rumination, that you're letting go of the guilt. Because again, we've never been here before. So how would we know to this, as you said, the freedom that you get to engage with the whole person when you let go of the guilt and rumination, not just the actions or the event or the death or the thing. In a way, ruminating on those things keep you from seeing the totality of that person and your relationship with them. And it keeps you from actually building a new relationship, which you talk about in the book too, which is really what we're doing as we move forward with grief, right? Yeah.
When we come back, Claire and I explore what it takes to move from an engaging orientation to a surrendering orientation in grief, and what a leap of faith it requires. You're listening to Grief is a Sneaky Bitch podcast. I'm your host, Lisa Kefauver. Everything sucks and other negative thoughts. This is your brain on grief. Oh, the places you go and the people you see and why it's exhausting. People say stupid shit. Watch out for the grief thief. Secondary losses, the sneakiest bitches of them all. The beautiful, messy, emerging you. Those are just a handful of the chapter titles for my forthcoming book, Grief is a Sneaky Bitch, An Uncensored Guide to Navigating Loss, hitting bookstores in June. But you don't have to wait until then to hear more. You can pre-order your copy of the book today at Amazon.com, bookshop.org, or barnesandnoble.com. As a special thank you for pre-ordering, I'm hosting a pre-launch party for everyone who does. It's happening on Zoom on May 22nd, which happens to be my birthday. I'll read some excerpts, answer your questions, dish about the behind the scenes of the podcast, and more. You can follow me on Instagram at Lisa Kefauver MSW, then DM me that you pre-ordered the book, and I'll share the party invite link with you. If you're not into that whole social media thing, don't worry about it. You can just drop me a note to info@lisakefauver.com. Hey, and I'm also starting to schedule book tour appearances across the country, starting with my book launch on June 4th at Warwick's Bookstore here in San Diego. If you're in the area, I'd love to meet you. But don't worry, if you don't live near here, I plan to hit the road and I'll have dates for you soon. I'm going to be showing up in places like LA, Seattle, Portland, New York, Boston, DC, Chicago, and of course my hometown, Ann Arbor, Michigan. Go Blue. If you want to keep up to date on where I'll be showing up, don't forget to sign up for my not-so-regular newsletter at lisakefauver.com/newsletter. I can't wait to meet you, both at the pre-launch party and in your city while on tour, to thank you so much for supporting the show and the book, and really just to take some time to celebrate life together. By the way, if you didn't hear your city named and you want me to come to you, drop me a note and let me know what destinations I should add to my tour. And if you have connections to a bookstore or other fun venue in your area, let me know that too. I want to share a formula with you that I think you might find interesting.
100% of us experience grief, plus we spend the majority of our waking hours in the workplace, equals grief is in your workplace right now. It's true. Remember, it's not just death loss. We experience grief in the wake of relationships ending, diagnoses, layoffs, high turnovers, restructuring, relocations, and even frightening and traumatic world events. Having been both an employee and a leader in deep grief over the years, 5 years ago, I set out to create impactful programming that helps organizations create a grief-smart and more compassionate culture. I've been fortunate over the years to deliver keynote addresses for mental health conferences, partnered with school districts to offer half-day intensives for educators, and offered ongoing workshop series on grief, loss, burnout, resiliency for a wide range of clients from Fortune 500 companies to medical residency programs, hospice organizations, and other social service entities. Conference planners have invited me to lead Ask the Expert panels, and leaders have also trusted me to offer consultation on specific situations facing their company. The surprising thing that they all had in common, it's that these opportunities all came from listeners like you. So if you're part of an organization or company that is impacted by grief, which, as we learned in the formula in the beginning, that means all of us, reach out to me at lisakefauver.com and we can work together to make your organizational culture grief smart.
And that's how we get from that like engaging to surrendering, right? Because the surrendering is that like leap of faith where we're just like, okay, I give up
this
here.
This isn't working anymore. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, we can hit walls and just be like, okay, all right, just lay me out. Show me what, you know, show me what's up, grief.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that surrendering to the being with whatever grief has for us is hard. Again, you talk about this so beautifully, and my listeners know I've talked about this in every place I can, from here to the TED stage to wherever, which is like, how could we know? Because we've never seen that. We've never seen that in the stories that we see on the big screen and the little screen. We rarely see that in our families and in our friends. And so to take that leap and to, on anything, by the way, not just grief, but just any, confronting anything hard or difficult or new, we see the like, never did it. And then we say, you're already perfect.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
We don't really like that like messy middle story where you're just like stumbling and falling and then feeling okay for a day and then slipping back into guilt and then moving, oscillating, right?
Yeah, that doesn't make for a good TV show.
No, I mean, I think it would,
but yeah.
And I think there is more and more media. I was talking about this in a Media Maker profile that I did, and I was saying, I do think we're seeing more and more, a little bit more, mm-hmm. you know, kind of messier stories. And I think that's so important because how else will we know it's okay or safe or possible to move from that kind of entering phase to that surrendering phase where we're being with the unknowable and the discomfort and the, you know, like the no, being at peace with no peace kind of thing. Mm-hmm. I feel like you had that quote of Eckhart Tolle in there about that, which I really loved. So one of the things that I'd love to hear you explore, what you even, your own experience of this, especially losing both parents so young in their life, I think one of the things that we arrive at, which I also think is not talked about nearly enough in grief, but it arrives sort of when we move into this orientation of surrendering, which is the loss of our own identity.
Mm-hmm.
Like, who am I even anymore? And that grief is its own, it's part of what leads to that like thing that we were talking about, the opportunity and getting clear. And there's some fun things that happen on the other side, but the kind of gut wrench that happens when we really come face to face with that loss of identity, when we experience a profound loss. What did you experience? What do you think we don't know? What do we need to know about what that looks like or feels like when we come to that?
I think in some ways it's different for different ages. You know, for me at 18, I was still
finding my identity or just about to forge out on my own and create one. Yeah. And so it got really leveled at an interesting time for me. But then, you know, I'll work with a lot of people who are, you know, 30s, 40s, 50s, and going through a really big loss and feeling like they don't know who they are anymore. And a lot of it's just your sense of the world changes, you know, your idea of what's possible, what's safe, what can happen in the world really shifts. And then you can begin to experience yourself on all these new levels of vulnerability, a fear, the guilt, shame you might feel, you know, all of these really deep cavernous places within ourselves that we often haven't touched like this before. And and they can be quite shocking for so many people. I think this is where a lot of anxiety comes in. You know, you suddenly don't trust yourself to go into work and like be the person you used to be, or to go to a party, or to be in your marriage, or whatever it is. You know, you're just not who you used to be. And it takes a little time to find this new version of yourself. And there is so much grief there of like, wait, I just really miss this person I used to. I used to be a little happier. I used to, you know, be a little more confident. I used to be naive. I used to feel safe in the world. And now I'm so different. And so there's definitely a period of grief that we go through as we come to terms with those changes. And then there's a new version of us that begins to emerge. Yeah. And often what we learn going through those things, I think that there are pieces where we really grow and in beautiful ways. It's so awful. You wouldn't trade it ever.
No.
Like I would take my parents back in a second for all the worldly compassion I've, you know, inhabited since they died. And I know, you know, we all would take our person back rather than have this beautiful growth. Yeah. But there is, you know, I am grateful for who I am because of these losses. I wouldn't be this person at all. You wouldn't be who you are without everything that you've been humbled by, dropped to your knees by, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. No, I appreciate that. It's just another example of the both and, right? Of the way our lives move. And, you know, for so many of us, myself included, again, I've been going through this whole identity thing again. I lost my husband, then I lost my friend, and this, my cancer diagnosis and all the things. The grief over my identity. The thing is, we're never going to go back. The door, it's like a one-way door. You know, once you go through it, this is a one-way door and it's not a circulating door. There's no going back as heart-wrenching as it is to be that person that you were in the before. And so then the question becomes, when you're ready, which if you're listening, you may not be ready and that's okay too, but when you're ready,
definitely okay.
Then the question becomes, then who am I? What pieces of me am I going to carry forward? What has this made clear that I don't want to carry forward? But I think it's important, as you said, about this correlation or this connection between sort of grieving this versions of ourselves that we, not just that we will never be again, the versions of ourselves in the before, but as I've often said, I think we grieve the versions of ourselves we'll never get a chance to become in the after. Because of this pivotal shift. And that experience of not sort of knowing who you are anymore for a time is so unsettling. I often use the term untethered. I felt very, very untethered from the world, from the ground, which is why like any kind of grounding meditation is always my go-to. I mean, it really feels like the world is spinning
disorienting.
Tossed around, right? And so I do think, and we're so busy being taught to grieve the person that so many of us don't give ourselves the chance to grieve us.
Yeah.
Wife, daughter, friend, whatever that experience, you know, healthy, well person. And that's such an important component of how we move forward through surrender. Yeah.
And this is what a lot of people on the outside, when you're grieving and going through a big loss, that this is what they're missing. They're not they don't understand this. They're not seeing this, you know, they're like, oh, your mom died, you know, like, keep going, keep moving on. And
she and wouldn't want you to.
The secondary losses that you're swirling within of yourself, of like possibly your home, other relationships, work, finances, like all the stuff that comes with a big loss. It's really, most people don't see it. And that can feel really lonely and really isolating and can cause all that self-doubt. Like, what is wrong with me? Why can't I get my act together?
Yeah, right. So if you're in that place where you're feeling that kind of swirl, and yes, of course, you're grieving your person, if it was a death loss, which of course we can grieve non-death losses. But if there's something else there, then maybe listen to this conversation when you read Claire's book. Start to be curious about whether some of this, I just keep calling it swirliness, but some of this untetheredness, some of this overwhelm is really about sort of not recognizing yourself in the mirror anymore and spending some time grieving that and then learning about what it is that you want to discover about this emerging version of you.
Yeah.
I think that's so beautiful. You know, you could definitely feel your therapist brain in there, but you made it so digestible in your book, In Conscious Grieving. But before we move on from surrendering to transforming, I wondered if you'd help us think through, speaking of like when we're in the swirl of overwhelm, how do we start to recognize when the weight of grief is just on us and on us and on us, the relationship between thought, emotion, behavior? You know, you sort of walked us through that in that great therapist way, but you made it so really accessible. But when we're someone who's maybe been spending some time in rumination or spending some time in guilt and shame or just spending some time in the overwhelm that is grief, what do we need to know about the relationship between thought, emotion, and behavior? And what might we shift?
I mean, I think it's something we need to be aware of throughout our lives always and kind of be paying attention to. But in grief, it's, you know, it's a really interesting time to look at that little chain. You know, we wake up in the morning and often the first thought in our head is, oh, my person is gone. Like, here's another day of like, oh my God, they're gone. Or whatever it is we're grieving, you know, this just all of a sudden it's the first thought in our minds in the morning. And from there, we go down a rabbit hole, right? It's like, my person is gone. And then you just, the feelings that come with that one thought, like all the feelings that come up, fear of the future and just getting through your day and the ache and the heartache and the anguish and trauma that might be there. And then from there, your behavior. What happens? You know, maybe you don't get out of bed. Maybe you smoke a cigarette. Maybe you like, you know, lash out at somebody on TikTok or so. I don't know. You know, like what is the behavior that ensues following those feelings? Yeah. And so starting to just have a gentle awareness of that chain is really important. So have the thought, start to notice all the feelings that come up, and then how do you want to tend to those feelings? You know, and what thoughts do you want to follow down rabbit holes? Like, our brain is like that little ticker tape screen on the news channel at the bottom with like just flowing by with all this stuff. And we can just keep going with it and just keep having these feelings and reactions. But we can also pause, you know, we can reach out for support. We can talk through what's coming up. We can write about our thoughts. So just, I think in grief, it's really important to have that gentle awareness. That you're going to have these thoughts that are so overwhelming. They're going to bring up all these feelings that you may not even be used to. And you're going to have a natural reaction of some kind of behavior to those feelings. Yeah. And some behavior is really helpful and some is not.
Been there, done that. All of us have. Yeah. And to approach that awareness of thought, emotion, behavior with, which you of course talk about in the book, but just want to reiterate for our listeners, with such self-compassion.
Yeah.
So when you start to notice that you get into that ticker tape or that wormhole of a certain thought that brings on a certain set of emotions, which by the way, our emotions are in our bodies. So if we can start practicing cueing into, you know, the tightness in our chest or the tension in our jaw or et cetera, and that we then lead into being in bed all day or yelling at our neighbor or, you know, calling in sick for work or drinking or drugging or whatever we do. That is not an invitation then to say, oh my God, what's wrong with me? See, there's, you know, and then you, and thus becomes that thought emotion. That's really an invitation, as you said, favorite word, pause. pause and be curious, like, oh, here is this thing that's happening again. And I wonder, I always say be a should detective, because usually the thoughts have the word should or shouldn't in them that lead you into maybe some of those more intense emotions. You know, I shouldn't have done this. I should do this. I shouldn't feel this way. Be a should detective. And that might begin to loosen or shift really the cycle, because you're always going to have thought, emotion, behavior, right? It's just which behavior.
When we come back, Claire opens up about how absolutely challenging she found offering herself compassion to be. And we explore some of the practices useful to softening to our own humanity with love and care. I'm your host, Lisa Kefauver. You're listening to Grief is a Sneaky Bitch podcast. I'm always up to something new. Like in March, I'm hosting an online workshop exploring the shoulds of grief and then flying to Cincinnati to deliver the keynote address and facilitate a workshop on the Forum on Aging. In April, I'm back online with folks like you, and this time we're going to learn about the healing power of beauty, wonder, and awe. You can find the links to register in the show notes for today's episode or by visiting lisakefauver.com. But truly, I'm a lifelong learner, and I'd love to share my discoveries with you. Whether it's something I learn interviewing new guests, lessons from attendees when I'm delivering a talk, reflections on entering a new stage of my own cancer treatment, to be honest, or even learning something new about grief or loss, healing, resiliency, by reading or taking a workshop of my own. The best way for me to share and to learn more about what you want to learn about is to sign up for my not-so-regular newsletter at lisakefauver.com/newsletter. Why is it called that? Well, because grief isn't on a schedule, and neither is my newsletter. I recently received this moving review on Apple Podcast, and it touched my heart so deeply that I wanted to share it with you. Allie Moncrief said, I began by cherry-picking from these amazing podcast episodes, ones that seemed to fit with what I needed as I navigated traveling to see my gravely ill brother on the heels of losing our dad and our family home. Then I just ended up listening to whichever one came next because they're all so good. There are so many profound pearls of reality and wisdom in these conversations, and I am so grateful to have found Lisa's podcast. As I travel this path, I honestly have a ton of fear. And I'm in awe of the energy that has allowed me to be just where I am with my brother. Lisa's particular grace and communication around grief have really helped support me in this wickedly challenging moment. Thank you so much. Thank you, Allie, for sharing. Friends, 5-star ratings and beautifully written reviews like these not only help the algorithm get the show out to more grievers who might need it most, it also inspires me to keep bringing you more and more important conversations. I'm 5 seasons into the show, and I love every bit of the process. The hundreds of thousands of downloads tell me that, yes, people are listening, but it doesn't really tell me what it means to listeners like you. So I humbly ask you, if you love the show, if one or more episodes have helped you in some way, please take the time to head to Apple Podcast or Spotify, subscribe to the show, click the 5 stars to leave a rating, and then click the pencil icon to write a review. Those few minutes it will take you to do that will mean the world to me, truly.
And I think if you can have that, if you can cultivate those moments of self-compassion within that pause, it's really much easier to choose a behavior that is going to be helpful and healing. When we beat ourselves up, oh, I shouldn't be feeling like this again. Can't believe it's another day and I'm feeling this, whatever the feeling is, guilt, anger, sadness, you know. Then we often lean into a behavior that's, you know, more self harm inflicting, you know, in some level. And so when we can have that self-compassion and just be like, oh, Claire, it's okay that you're feeling this. Your mom died, you know, give yourself a little love.
Yeah. I love that. Which is hard, by the way, because we
so hard.
We're in a productivity obsessed, get better, healed, like it's an ED as opposed to an ING, like we're always healing. Yeah. It's so hard. Gita's just coming to my mind today because she's coming back to my life, my meditation teacher. She invited me to do this thing in one of those thought, emotion, behavior phases of my life, to put your hand over your heart and to just say, call yourself sweetie, which I thought was, might feel weird to some of us, but to some of us, it felt so nice. And to say, how could it be any other way? Of course it is, sweetie. How could it be any other way? And I just thought that kind of tender, loving compassion, which frankly, many of us are not going to get from the people in our lives. Mm-hmm. Many of our grief supporters are going to be like, you know, move on, get better. How come you're feeling this way? So yeah, tending to yourself in that orientation of surrender is becoming practiced at noticing, pausing, tending to yourself, and giving yourself a chance to make different behavior choices.
Yeah.
Which also will give you a chance back to what you were talking about earlier, which is to start to see the world in a different way, yourself in a different way, to have those growth, to have that growth, right? When you're not stuck in the loop.
And just, I just want to reiterate, self-compassion is not easy. You know, like when I first started to work on it, I would just weep and weep. I hated myself so much. It was so hard to show even just a little bit of self-compassion and tenderness. And it was scary. And I think, you know, I had to like fake it till I made it, you know, and I think that's okay. You know, that I always think about like Stuart Smalley on Saturday Night Live, like I'm good enough, I'm smart enough, and God damn it, dog it, like people love me or whatever. And like I had to do that. I just had to like say stuff that I didn't even believe. Like I had to be like, Claire, you're a good person, or you're like okay, you're safe, you're loved, you're like you can do this. And I didn't even believe it. But saying those things was better than saying like, Claire, you're a terrible person. You don't deserve love. And so I just kept saying those things until I started to even just feel little glimmers of them.
Yeah. No, it's so I invite people all the time, including myself, to say, would you talk to your best friend with that mouth? You know, like we talk to ourselves in ways that we wouldn't. And I think that self-compassion and self-forgiveness can be hard. Again, going back to like, because then it feels like then we're saying it's okay that that bad thing happened. We kind of conflate those two things. And it's like that bad thing that happened, your person dying, you not having a chance to be there, that sucks. That's always going to suck. And if you stay tethered to that and don't allow yourself compassion and forgiveness, you know, then you are basically in that stuck place and that you have a harder time bringing that person forward in that kind of light and in beautiful way. So, but I appreciate you saying that. I do think self-forgiveness, I'm still working on it myself. I mean, it is, it's a practice, I would say. Self-compassion is a practice. It's not something you like
It's achieve. It's a practice, exactly.
You're not, I would imagine, I don't know for sure, but Kristen Neff, you know, sort of guru of self-compassion would say herself that it's a practice, right? Even she is not like arrived there.
And I think that's okay. You know, I think there's so many things that are a practice and just like coming back to it every day and,
And seeing our common humanity, I think is really, of course, a key part of our self-compassion. And that's another thing that I think isn't culturally so taught to us. Right. And so I think there's lots of reasons why it has to be a practice because we're sort of fighting against all these different cultural sort of norms or lessons that we learn even subconsciously. So you helped us think about, you call it entering, but I also call it being shoved in because none of us are willingly walking through that door. But let's say we're entering, we're engaging, and hopefully maybe we've moved from engaging in those ways that are actually resisting, like rumination and guilt, and we're learning to be with our emotions, to pause, to attend to, we're surrendering, we're beginning to recognize the fact and have kindness towards ourselves that we have an emerging identity, that we're having to grieve some versions of ourselves that we were in the before. Sort of the fourth area orientation, and I would imagine, of course, for each loss and even as we re-grieve later down the road, we might, you know, vacillate back and forth. But you sort of think, help us think about that fourth orientation as transformation, which includes things like, you know, I think Hope Edelman calls it the after grief, which you refer to in the book, right? Or these grief triggers, grief waves. As we're recording this, we're November, December, actually today's December 1st, right? So we are certainly entering a seasonal time for many of us that we experience somatically around grief waves. What do we need to know about this transforming orientation or around the sort of after grief that we carry forward in the, you know, after that first year?
Yeah, I think there's like a lot of layers to the transforming, and it's like something that we can come back to many times. And like you said, with the hopes after grief, you know, we can enter into grief multiple times. We can engage with it in different ways and different times, even the same loss, you know, over and over. We can surrender to it again and again. We may have to, it may come back up and we may have to surrender again. And in the same way, we transform through it multiple times in multiple ways. And it's like what we were saying about this identity shift that occurs after loss, where it takes time. It's not something that happens right away. It's not like you get to just choose to suddenly embrace this new identity, because the identity itself is forming. You're kind of like
through the new experiences, right?
Yeah. I mean, you're like peeled down to some new essence and you're like, whoa. And then you start to build up into a new place with it. And that's a lot of the kind of transformation. And it's starting to look at these changes. It's starting to accept that this is what has happened and this is your life going forward. I mean, I think there's many ways in which we can push back on. Acceptance doesn't mean you're okay with what happened or that, you know, you're fine now that that person's gone. It just means that you're accepting that this has happened and this is the life path that you are now on, you know? And I think even just coming to that, I mean, I would trick myself for years after my mom died. I would think, and I never knew I was until the moment it happened, right? So like I would graduate college and I would suddenly just like, at my graduation, like fall to my knees sobbing, like, wait, I thought she would come back if I like got this far. Like, I thought like if I grieved for this many years and this hard and I like accomplished these things that maybe she'd come back. And like, shit, this whole time I've been thinking that like, and I didn't even realize I was thinking that. And so then I would have to like roll into this new wave of acceptance that like this was my life and I was going to live my whole adult life without my mom. And, but then there would be a transformation that would kind of come within that space, right? Like, because there would become a new acceptance of the identity that I was forming and inhabiting. Yeah. And a new like acceptance of these pieces that were really occurring around the new ways I was seeing the world, the kind of new strengths I was bringing to it that I never wanted in the first place. Yeah. But like, wow, okay, I do have some really interesting things I'm bringing to my life and to the world at large as well. Transformation can be tiny. It can be big. It can be noticeable. It can be invisible. But I think there's a lot of beauty to be found within it. Whenever my kids now are going through stuff, I'm like, oh, I just want to shield them from everything, you know? And then I have to stop and I think, God, every horrible thing that has ever happened to me has made me better, smarter, more compassionate, more aware of the world, like given me tools with which to move forward. And so I don't want to take that away from them, you know?
Yeah. Those resiliencies that we gain when we move through hard things, again, would trade it in a heartbeat for, you know, getting our person back, and isn't a thing that we need to hold ourselves to, you know, because we're so tech, you know, it's like, hurry up and get to post-traumatic growth, which isn't for everybody, or to resiliency in this way that it's like just another checklist of things that we have to do. And as you said, these things that we go through are the material.
Yeah. And none of them mean the source material. You have to stop grieving. You know, transformation doesn't mean you're not still holding grief and honoring your person and your relationship and wishing they were still here. Resilience doesn't mean you're not grieving anymore. Yeah. Post-traumatic growth doesn't mean you've stopped grieving. It's an and, you know.
I so appreciate that. And the listeners are, you know, maybe tired of hearing me say that, but obviously, and is my favorite word tattooed on my body and everything. But I think that is so important. And I want to reiterate something you just touched on, which I think is important. When we experience these, you know, graduation and your mom's not there, these milestones, these anniversaries, these holidays, that it could be a song, it could be a season of the year, it could be whatever. And we feel a renewed intensity of emotions, or a new memory comes up, or a new whatever comes up for us, or it feels like we did before, to just hear us when we say that's normal, that isn't a sign of, oh, you didn't do the work before, or you were just tricking yourself before. You did something, just like waves, you did something, and then this new thing happened. And when we tumble back again, to have compassion, to be curious, to pause, to think about and to notice and be aware, what is the new information coming forward for me? Like, what might I want to carry forward? I have definitely been, you know, I think grieving again in a new way, the death of my husband, which was 12 years ago, because I've had to walk through this entire cancer journey alone, right? And so, you know, it doesn't mean that I didn't grieve him before, although I definitely tried to trick myself into being like, God, girl, what, like, haven't you figured this out already? But I think that's normal too. And it's, you're not starting over. I just promise. Just if you're hearing us and you feel like you're tumbled into that wave,
that's how
it's new old grief.
Yeah. It's the same grief, but it's, you're experiencing it in a new way.
Yeah. And you have all of the, just like resiliency, like you have all of the building blocks of all of the learning, all of the reckoning with, all of the metabolizing that you did before. So you're not starting from scratch, even though it can feel that way. And the fear can be, you know, intense when it feels like, am I here again?
Yeah.
No, I so appreciate that. And I know you touched towards the end of the book about, you know, part of our transforming, which is very personal to us. And you brought up, Finding the Words, Colin Campbell. He talks about this so beautifully in his book too. But part of how we carry our person forward when we've let go of the guilt and rumination, when we're in this phase of transformation, is to think about, what are the rituals and legacy? How do we honor and carry forward our relationships with our person? What have you seen in your work with folks as we begin to wrap up our conversation today that is important for us to know about ritual or legacy honoring, about that phase?
I mean, I think we need it. I think we really deeply need it when we're grieving and when we're just trying to reconcile the relationship we had with someone, something, a way of being, you know, whatever it is we've lost. We're trying to reconcile that relationship that is no longer here in the way that we once had it. And it's the incongruence we can feel when we just try to go from like, okay, it's gone, I'm just going to keep moving forward. No, we need some kind of ritual around it. And it can be, it can be something that's so simple. It can be something we make up, something we intuit, something we steal from a different, you know, idea. I've taken lots of bits and pieces from all kinds of things. One of my favorite, just really simple ideas that I love is, I was meeting with a rabbi for a while when I was working on a book about the afterlife. And he was explaining to me at one point that in Judaism, there's not a big emphasis on the afterlife being this place where we go. And it's more, the afterlife is what we leave behind, you know, our legacy, who we were in this lifetime, the good deeds we did, the ways we changed people, the ways we helped people, what we've passed down to the people we love. And so in that sense, like, it's just so beautiful. You know, my parents' afterlife is now, it's in me. Yeah. It's playing out right here, and I don't have to do anything besides embody, you know, the beautiful parts of them in order to give them an afterlife. And I don't have to believe in anything specific and figure anything out about religion or spirituality or heaven or whatever it is. I can just embrace that idea. And that's so simple and beautiful. And that's a way of honoring them, you know, and that gives me a connection to them. It gives me a sense of warmth and peace in some ways. And so when I think about ritual and honor, it can be as simple as that.
And it can be much bigger, of course, like very demonstrative and symbolic and all kinds of things. But I do think that it's an important part of grief and of loss.
Yeah. No, I so appreciate that. And, you know, listeners, I think if you, maybe you already have a ritual that's around the birthday or the anniversary of the death or a particular holiday, et cetera, or maybe you don't. And so just to hear Claire, just to reiterate that it doesn't have to be demonstrative or public. It doesn't have to be the same every year. I think we have this pressure, like we have to come up with this ritual that we do exactly that way. And it's really about listening inward. How do I want to carry this relationship forward, and what actions, internal or external, grand or small, might I take on a particular day or on a Tuesday or on because you're thinking of that person?
Yeah.
And the more we can have sort of grace and flexibility for how that shows up in our lives, then I think the more kind of intuitively we can move forward as we move forward with our grief. My different rituals have certainly changed over time. Yeah. And just to name that to for Liz, because I felt in the beginning like, well, we didn't have a particular thing we did every year. My daughter really was so young, she didn't want to be involved. And so then I felt a lot of pressure, like, am I not honoring him by not having some thing? And it's really taking me to be like, I get to say I was married to an amazing man named Eric here on the podcast. And that's a way of bringing him forward. So however you choose to do it is just trusting to your own intuition and to, and to leaning on the wisdom of, as you said, other religions, friends, things, ideas you see wherever you go. Claire, what an absolute treasure it has been spending this time with you today. I'm so grateful that our paths have finally crossed after all of the years. It's been a minute, but we will be together again soon. Listeners, I'm going to drop a link in the show notes. Conscious Grieving, by the time this episode drops, will be available on all your favorite booksellers and in your favorite local bookstores. I always love to encourage that. Check it out. Conscious Grieving, A Transformative Approach to Healing from Loss. Thanks so much, Claire.
Thank you so much, Lisa. This was such a pleasure for me as well. Thank you.
Thanks.
Friends, didn't I tell you that Claire's warmth and wisdom would leave you feeling supported in your grief? I encourage you to check out Claire's body of work, including this fifth book of hers, Conscious Grieving, hitting bookstores March 12th. If you're listening before then, you don't have to wait. You can pre-order it today on your favorite online bookseller. Also, Claire offers a wide array of workshops, retreats, and more. So head over to clairebidwellsmith.com to learn more. Now, don't forget, you can pre-order my forthcoming book, Grief is a Sneaky Bitch, An Uncensored Guide to Navigating Loss, on your favorite online bookseller. When you do, don't forget to drop me a note and let me know so I can send you an invite to my pre-order book launch party. Oh, and this season, I'm working to get every unedited video up on my new YouTube channel at Lisa Kiefhofer MSW. So head over there and subscribe. Thanks for listening to yet another episode of Grief is a Sneaky Bitch podcast. If you found today's episode helpful, don't forget to share this episode with others who might need it too. If you do it on socials, don't forget to tag me at Lisa Kiefhofer MSW. And of course, if you loved it, leave a 5-star rating and write a review wherever you listen. I want to give a big thanks to Mike Moody at Permanent Record for the audio engineering support and Giles Smith of Alafia Sound for providing the music. Until next time, my friends, I see you, I hear you, and I'm holding you in my heart.